Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I am chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org and view the online calendar of upcoming club events. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today, Ruth Halpern. Ruth is speaking tonight on Galvanize Your Colleagues with Powerful Storytelling. I'm going to read you a brief bio on Ruth, and then I'm going to introduce her to tell her story. Ruth Halpern has been helping people and organizations tell their best stories for over 20 years. Her background includes work as a consultant to corporations and public institutions. She delivers storytelling performances and presentation training for audiences, including high-level managers and nonprofit activists. She taught management communications at JFK University for 3 years and also performs original and improvised stories solo and as part of her troupe, Storytellers Unplugged. Introduce Ruth Halpern. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. There are seats up front, of course. I'm so delighted that so many people have come to learn more about your natural storytelling ability and how to put it to work in business. And of course, I'm going to begin with a story. So please get comfortable and note as I step over to the computer and touch the letter B. Best PowerPoint trick I know. Long ago, they say, truth walked naked through the city. Every door she knocked on was slammed in her face. The people who passed her on the street turned their eyes away, embarrassed, humiliated. Truth, no one wanted anything to do with her. At last, she sat down on the curb and wept. The world had no interest in knowing her. She might as well leave. And it was at that moment that story happened by. Dressed in her flying colors, wearing that cloak of mystery and suspense, and there was Truth sitting weeping on the curb, Story said, here, take this, and wrapped her in that cloak. Come with me, we'll walk together. And suddenly Story and Truth, hand in hand, were welcomed everywhere, into the grand palaces, into the little houses. Everyone wanted to know Truth when she came with Story. That's what they used to say, but I have to update this story for you now. Because now it is data that walks naked through the corporate corridors, click, click, clicking on her high PowerPoint heels. And as she enters the room, eyes glaze over. Blackberries are discreetly extracted and navigated. No one wants to know data. Until she comes wrapped in Story. And that's why we're here tonight, to learn how to create that melding of an important business message with a narrative that engages people. Now, I could quote you a lot of statistics on this topic because the subject of business narrative is now an area of scholarly exploration. But as you know, 76% of Americans make up statistics on a regular basis. And there's no point in me, a storyteller, even trying. You already know. I'm not going to have the numbers as tightly as I have this knowledge. When we hear stories, we hear them with a different part of our brain than we do data or grocery lists or top priorities or mission statements. Stories actually have been charted, and they are received in the image, in the visual cortex part of the brain. We are instantly creating the worlds that stories give us. And that's been scientifically proven. I would go further and assert that humans are story-making animals. We can't help it. We need stories to survive. We don't want to live a life of just, and then this, and then this, and then this, with no apparent connection. So we use story to make sense of our lives. You can't talk about who you are, where you come from, where you're headed, without telling a story. And it's not in our control. You're driving down the highway. Somebody's going 40 miles an hour in the slow lane, and you're trapped behind them. You're making up a story. Who is this idiot? Are they texting while they drive? What is going on? But let me ask you, how does the story change when that car becomes a 1965 Cadillac and you can barely see the driver over the steering wheel? Now, how does the story change when it's a pickup truck with plant material and gardening tools sticking out the back and it's still going at that speed? We're making up stories all the time. Moreover, if you're communicating a business message, your audience is making up stories all the time too. And if you're not consciously creating those stories, they are. So when you bring up a list of PowerPoint bullets, people are trying to weave them into their own narrative and make them make sense and try and keep themselves engaged and caring about them so that they don't fall asleep, which is so embarrassing. So as communicators, I'm not suggesting that you don't need the data. I'm suggesting that it needs to be structured as much as possible with narrative in mind. Narrative has been proven to be the most memorable and the most motivating form of communication. Now, some of you may be thinking, oh, that's fine for her, but I'm not a natural storyteller. And I want to tell you a story about that. Before you all arrived, I was talking with Celia, one of the volunteers here, and she nervously told me that she despises and loathes public speaking. It makes her a nervous wreck, and she stutters. So I asked her whether she remembered any vividly memorable teachers from when she was a kid. And she said, of course, and she named their names, you know, the one who taught Latin and the one who taught Greek. And then she said, there was the teacher who encouraged me to think about myself as a writer. He came to school drunk every Monday morning, and he got me to write. She didn't stutter. She didn't check her notes. She didn't break eye contact with me to go off into the ozone and plan what she was going to say. It was a story she was the expert on and that she cared passionately about, and it came across in everything she said. And she told me I could tell you that story. So that's what we want to tap into. Regardless of where you're telling your story, you have inside you that natural, improvisational storytelling style, and it's just a matter of enlisting it. And in many settings, I would give you lots of chances to practice. But today, no. You have to sit there and just think about this. But that's going to mean an explosion of conversation when the presentation is over as you try out some of these ideas, I hope. All right, so I want to wake up my screen again. And I want to begin by defining terms. So come, there's seats up front. You don't have to wiggle all the way across. Welcome. I've already told you a couple of stories, and I want to start by saying that when I encourage you to tell a business narrative, it does not have to be literary. It doesn't have its roots in the folk tradition. It doesn't need all kinds of descriptive embellishment, but it does need certain elements to qualify as a story. The first of those is that it needs to be an anecdote or an image that's actually about people. Corporations are really tough main characters of stories. They're just too vague and abstract. An element of governmental bureaucracy may be a good villain, but hard as a main character. And there has to be, of course, a reason for the story. And when you start telling it, you need to already know what it is. You need to know what point you're trying to make with your story. The second element is that as you structure it, there have actually been studies that show that PowerPoint in the last 10 years has changed how we think. We want to let go of that weird linear hierarchical thinking. That's not how narratives grow. They're organized in terms of cause and effect. And there's a great example that comes from E.M. Forrester. Here's the difference between a list of facts and a story. The list of facts is the queen died and then the king died. A story is the queen died and then the king died of grief. So we want those cause and effect relationships as part of our narrative. And we also want some vivid details. We want sensory moments, and they don't have to be elaborate. It could just be that the donuts on the coffee table or on the conference table were stale. And that brings us into the sensory world of where your story takes place. And strong emotions, really important in a good story. In the business world, we're taught often that emotions don't belong here. We wear our corporate mask. We conduct ourselves in a dignified manner. There is no crying in baseball. And we leave out the emotions. And that's a mistake because they are there and they are part of the story. So we need to find chances to weave them in. And finally, it's really important that you know how your story is going to end and that it take you somewhere. So you want to either take it to an ending of a known nature or an open-ended ending, depending on the type of story, that invites the audience in to help you create the conclusion or the next chapter, the sequel. But it does need to take us somewhere. It isn't enough to tell a story. It needs to arrive at a point where people know what to do next. Okay. Before we move on, I want to give a great example of that that I experienced a couple of years ago. Has anyone heard Gavin Newsom speak? Excellent. So you know that he's a master of this weaving together of data and narrative. I was at a charitable luncheon, an annual luncheon with an award ceremony, and there were about 500 people at round tables in a huge, huge banquet hall. And Gavin Newsom came in, late, as usual, bounded up onto the podium, apologized, immediately acknowledged the members of the organization. He knew what they were there for. He knew what we stood for. And then he began filling us in on his program in the administration, and it was several years ago, but he was working on homelessness issues. He was very passionate about getting citywide wireless, and he had a few data points about how things were doing. Do I remember them? No, but I remember that he ended up by talking about a visit he had had recently with the mayor of the capital of Latvia, which is a sister city of San Francisco. And he was showing the mayor around San Francisco. And remember, Latvia is a very tiny country on the Baltic Sea. And he was showing him around and talking about all the accomplishments and what was coming with wireless access to city governance. And the mayor stopped him and put his arm on Gavin's shoulder and said, "Wait, you mean your citizens can't pay their parking tickets on their cell phones? They can't file their property taxes using texting?" And Gavin Newsom said, "So? We have a ways to go to catch up with Latvia, but we're working on it." And he thanked us very much, and he was gone. What a great anecdote. Not only does it put what he's working on into really vivid imagery, but it's also charmingly self-deprecating. He's not saying, "I'm the greatest hero in the world." He's saying, "I'm a work in progress, and I'm ready to learn. I'm ready to be inspired." So I thought that was just a lovely example of the ways that weaving your story into the facts that you're trying to communicate ends up with a more powerful message. There are many other great orators I could cite, but that's the example that has really stayed with me. So there are certain stories that everybody needs to tell, whether in a business context or a social context or that dangerous melding when you're on the sidelines of your kid's soccer game and you realize that the person you're talking to could actually be an interesting colleague. And I call those your hip pocket stories, things that you want to have already thought out, maybe even tried out, before the moment when you need them most. So I'm going to talk at some length about a whole bunch of different categories of business narratives that you may find that you need to tell. And noting my footnote, a lot of these ideas come from the work of a writer named Stephen Denning, who has written a book called The Leader's Guide to Storytelling and is one of the great thinkers about the ways that storytelling can help in a business context. There's a chair up front if you'd like to come. So Stephen Denning got his start working in the World Bank as a planner and communicator and internal visionary, basically. And he had this idea over 10 years ago that the World Bank, which is a monetary service and lending organization, really has a lot more to offer the world than money. Because of its expertise in countries and cultures from every part of the globe, there's information that that the World Bank could be sharing that it wasn't. And he went before the leaders and he went before the boards of managers and so on. And he would say, "We have this other mission that we could really make a difference in the world." And they would say, "Our story is about money. We lend money." And they weren't able to expand their narrative at all. And he tried PowerPoints and he tried posting informational notices in the lunchroom and all kinds of things. And he finally crafted a story. This is how it goes. There's an aid worker in Africa who's trying to find information about ways that small communities can spread the word about AIDS awareness. And she makes her way to an internet cafe, and she sits down at that gritty keyboard, and she starts searching the internet for information on ways to publicize and ways to share information on AIDS prevention. And there's only one thing missing from this picture. which is that the World Bank was not sharing any of its information on the subject. She would have found nothing of what we in the World Bank know. And it was that story that made a difference. It was that story that gave people a new vision of moderating their narrative to include a greater service than just, we're about money. So it's a small story. I added the part about the Sandy keyboard because I just couldn't stop myself. It's not necessary. If you gave her a name, if you made her ride a red rusty bicycle, that would be excessive. That would take us out of the point of this story, which is to get us to the negation, the absence of what the World Bank could contribute. So that's what I mean when I say it doesn't have to be literary. It doesn't have to be embroidered. It has to be crafted consciously to convey your message. So one of the stories that probably everybody in here has to answer or tell is the answer to the question, what do you do? Told it recently? Okay, now there's a couple of different ways to answer it. There's what I call the dead fish method, which is your job title. Your job title lies there on the table like a dead fish, and everyone looks at it and says, it's a fish, all right. But it doesn't take us on a journey. So as you're thinking about ways to answer the question, what do you do, think about an answer that's vivid. It may not even include your job title at all. An answer that is memorable. Maybe it's a little bit out of left field. And I would say, most important, let it be mysterious. Let it make people want to learn more. Here's an example of that. I met a woman who told me, I help people sleep better and enjoy life more. Excellent. I immediately want to sign up. I don't know anything more about it than that. Well, it turns out she's a hypnotherapist. Now, if she laid that job title on the table, dead fish style, I might not be so intrigued. I might already have a story that tells me, that's not for me. But when it's a narrative about what she's doing to help people and it's full of mystery, I absolutely want to know more. So I would encourage you, as you think about crafting your answer to what do you do, to leave the job title out. I like to tell people, I help people and organizations tell their best stories. And hopefully they say, what does that mean? Because it's a little ambiguous and not everybody in the world could have the dead fish of business narrative consultant, which begs some questions. But so everybody needs to be able to tell a story in answer to this question. And it's okay if it doesn't answer the whole question. It's great if it makes people want to know more, and it's also great if it makes people remember you. Excuse me. This is not my ordinary voice. All right, so somehow you need to be able to tell the story of what it is you do. Another category of stories that everyone needs to tell is stories that build people's trust in you. And there's a couple of ways to think about this. You may be doing this kind of storytelling in a job interview. You may be doing it as a newcomer to an organization wanting to find ways to build bridges. I heard about a CEO who bravely turned off his 40-slide PowerPoint deck and told a story about himself, trembling, I would suspect, as he did it, and discovered that by revealing himself through a story, he actually built a bridge with his employees so that they could tell him their stories in return, and it created a much more powerful connection than a PowerPoint ever could have. So you may be wondering, what am I doing here with a PowerPoint? Well, it's a lot of information. So when I don't want you to be paying attention to it, I black it out. But there is a purpose, there is a benefit in at least giving people a skeleton of your ideas, but trying to keep their focus on you. So stories that build trust in you. It's a self-portrait through action, and you get to choose how self-revealing you want to be. Some of the best examples of who you are as a person may come from outside the business context. Surprise, because you are a whole person. You can make choices about when and how you want to incorporate those into your storytelling repertoire. But if you think about what is known as behavioral interviewing, a lot of questions that come up are, can you tell us about a time when, which is the lead into a story. I remember a time. And again, you're trying to choose stories that will build bridges. So let me give you an example. It was a bright, cold day in October, and I was standing in the carpool lane line in the East Bay. Is everybody familiar with the carpool? No rules written, no organizer, no boss. You stand on a street corner, people pick you up, take you to San Francisco, goodbye, thank you. There are unwritten rules, though. Do not talk unless the driver talks. Do not ask them to change the radio station. Do not backseat drive, and don't bring food in the car. So I'm in line, and I'm bored, and I'm looking forward to another day in San Francisco. And then I look up and notice that I'm the third person in line, and the fourth car in line is a little dark blue sports car, completely unlike the clown car that is parked in my driveway with dents and missing hubcaps. And I think, I'd like to ride in a car like that. So I let somebody go in front of me so I could ride in this cool car. I'm very tall. Car is very small. I immediately break the rule about not talking, and I'm just chatting away. What a lovely butterscotch leather interior. It's amazing that I can fit in this car. And the traffic is terrible. So the driver and I introduce ourselves by first names and end up talking for 45 minutes. Found out that he was married to his job. I mentioned that I had cooked a beautiful poached halibut the night before for one. Conversation flowed easily. We complained about traffic. We talked about how there's nowhere else to live. There was a tiny break in the traffic, and he gunned the engine, and this little Porsche zoomed up over the on-ramp and down. And then I mentioned that in addition to being a storytelling consultant, I'm a technology consultant. And he said, oh, my gosh, my business partner needs your help so badly. She is such a technophobe. Can I have your card? Gave him my card. We were at the bus station. Goodbye. And I got out of the car, thinking, if this guy doesn't call me, I give up on men forever. I will never understand anything. But he called. He left a message that afternoon from my chauffeur. He identified himself. And he said, there's an amazing coincidence about your business card. You should give me a call. So I called him. We have the same mailing address. We rent P.O. boxes from the same P.O. service on Shattuck. I said, wow, that's amazing. He said, but that's not the reason that I told you you should call. There's a bigger coincidence. You all know that my last name is Halperin. This guy on the phone, he tells me, my name is Mark Halperin. I didn't believe him, rudely, I might add. But we kept talking, and after about 45 minutes, he asked me out for breakfast. And after about a year and a half, we got married. So there is my story. And now you know a lot more about me. And I thought, wow, should I tell this story tonight in a business setting? But I want you to know I'm a risk taker. You already know I'm a talker. And you know that I have some tools for finding somebody, a stranger, who can bridge that storytelling gap. So that's an example of a way that you can use a story that's somewhat self-revealing to let people know more about who you are, and you will receive stories in return. People will find a new connection with you. It may be outside the business context, and they will leap upon it and cross that bridge and come across to you. So think about what are the attributes you want to convey and find stories that will help you do that. And it's not just you. It's your organization as well. Organizational storytelling is a really critical part of creating a culture that works. Because an organization's story that they tell internally has to match the story they're telling the outside world, or everybody who works there will know. Right? We all have very good bull detectors. We know when the outside message about caring about people isn't matched, let's say, by the sick leave policy. So consciously crafting a story for an organization is something that groups of people get together and try to do, and sadly, it often results in a mission statement. One of the most abstract kinds of statements. Maybe there's a person in there called we. We believe, we serve, we this or that, but there's no real action. So for every mission statement that I read on every corporate website, I wish that right next to it there was a story. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the story of where they came from. It could be the story of where they want to be in 5 years. But give me some grounding, something about the way people are going to move through their lives and their actions that helps me understand what the mission statement really means. And organizations need to work very hard on that, because business speak is abstract speak, and bringing it back to earth and putting real characters into the narrative can be very tricky. Examples of companies that are doing it. Has anyone noticed Sutter Health, the giant, is now inviting people to come to their website and tell their patient stories? And I think it works in a number of ways. For one thing, it's community building. Right? The whole notion of social marketing is built on the fact that we want people to listen to our stories and we want to hear other people's stories. And that is unchanged since the birth of the brain, I really do believe. People talk sometimes about how no one tells stories anymore. People tell stories all the time. They just don't necessarily craft them carefully and make choices about whether the story is serving their real mission. So on the other hand, you've got Ben and Jerry's. You've got Craigslist, companies whose identity that they share with the outside world matches what goes on inside. And that kind of a story is especially important when you think about startups, because I do a lot of work with internet startups. And often the lead storyteller is the lead engineer. Great at techno-speak, passionate, articulate, detailed, whew, incomprehensible. Helping people move down the abstraction ladder back down to concrete people sitting in public places using internet utilities that are actually part of a narrative is a big part of my job. So you may be thinking already about the stories that are both consciously told in your organization and also the water cooler, scuttlebutt, because those stories often constitute the really true story about what the organization is about. So you want to be crafting those as carefully as possible. So there are several genres of these. What you stand for, where you came from. Often the history of an organization gets lost as new hires join in and they don't quite understand the origin or the roots or why the culture is the way it is. And of course, where you're headed, because if you're not going anywhere, who wants to join the journey? It's a dead end. So all of those are elements of an organization's story. Now, there are also stories that you need to use to motivate people to action. Better than saying, you better, or if you don't, you'll, is a good story. So as I mentioned in one of my storytelling roles, I'm a technology consultant, and often I'm working in settings where people are being given a whole load of new technology that they didn't ask for and they don't want. Right? Every single one of us here is suffering from technology fatigue. We've learned new systems. We've memorized new keyboard shortcuts. Our devices change every 2 years. We're exhausted. And it can be painful to be sat down and told, guess what, here comes another round. So I use this story. At this very moment, let's pretend we're in front of the computers to be changed. We are on a flight to Athens, Greece. And we don't speak Greek. If you do speak Greek, modify this to another country. You've never been there. Nobody asked if you wanted to go. And it's a one-way ticket. When you arrive there, you're going to have to find a place to sleep. You're going to have to be able to order food somehow. You're going to have to make a few friends. It's going to be terrifying. The words will scatter on your tongue. You won't be able to figure out what to say at first. But the good news is you will have excellent tour guides with you who are bilingual and fluent. And once you pick up a few words in Greek, you'll discover the people are incredibly friendly. The food is the best in the world, and it's gorgeous. And there will come a time when your memory of the distant world of black and white DOS or WordPerfect or whatever it is you're pining for will fade and Greece will feel like home. So let's go on the journey. So that's an example of a story that is trying to move people forward, acknowledging their pain, but not hanging out with it. And clearly, there's an invitation to be part of the story, to go on that journey. In fact, as I said, you don't have a choice, so you're on board. Into the future. Okay, now there's another kind of story that some people shy away from or even run from when it begins, which is stories that transmit knowledge, experience, and understanding. And often these happen in the jargon of whatever trade the storyteller practices. So if you speak that jargon, these can be incredible stories. Do you remember that time at midnight when all the servers crashed at once and we were up to our elbows in cables and we finally found the one that the mouse had gnawed through and we had some gaffer tape and we actually fixed the chewed cable? And everyone goes, oh, yeah, we better keep gaffer tape in the kit, right? That's a story that preserves institutional learning. So smart organizations create opportunities for people to share those stories, to create mentoring relationships where the old hand gets a chance to tell those stories to the newcomers and pass on the institutional memory. The thing about these stories is know your audience. So I think a key part for managers to think about is making time for these stories. I worked with a healthcare organization that was providing nursing home care for seniors and people with dementia and people recovering from serious surgery. And the people on the front lines of that work so hard. And they work with life and death to create opportunities for them to share their stories, to talk about a moment, to talk about something they said or a touch they gave someone that made a difference. Is enriching the entire staff both by sharing knowledge and by saying, we value this work. We don't want you to have these experiences in isolation. We're part of a community doing this work. And of course, you want to show, if you're trying to impress your audience, that you speak their lingo. So you want to be able to incorporate the jargon into your story, but framing it as a story is going to help make it memorable and motivating. Final story type. Stories that tame rumors. There's a rumor going around that we're all going to be laid off on September 15th. You can't stand up and say, nuh-uh. You can't stand up and say, here's five reasons why that rumor is wrong, because we all know that layoffs are going on and we know that these are scary times. So the best response to a rumor is a good story. And the thing about that story is that it has to ring true. It has to ring truer than the story you're trying to combat. So a counter story might be, on September 15th, we're going to make sure that every single employee in the company knows where we stand, what our plans are, and how we're dealing with the economic realities of our particular industry. Then they know, oh, that sense of suspense and that sense that people are hustling around talking September 15th is based in something. But they have more information. They know what the story is. So without straying too far down the road of healthcare reform, that's a classic example of a place where we're really talking about story versus story. Same in a courtroom. Often it comes down to story versus story. And consciously crafting a story that is not a direct point-by-point rebuttal, but that is a reframing, is a critical storyteller's tool, excuse me. And it can be done. So some of my clients are trial lawyers who say, I know that in the courtroom the best story wins, but I'm trying an intellectual property case that is so abstract and happens on the micro level, I don't know how to convey it to a jury of lay people. Gotta have a good story. Got to have those vivid images and maybe even some emotion to bring the case alive. Oops, I said it was the final, but there's one more. The greatest one of all, the story that conveys a vision, something bigger than just, oh, a change is coming, like you're getting new technology, but that talks about where you're headed and why people should join you, your organization, your mission. You want to move people into the future and overcome resistance to change, which is a huge barrier. So there's a really good genre of business books that used to be sold at Stacy's, which is no more. Stacy's Bookstore, sorry, moment of mourning. which is the business parable. And usually they're less than 100 pages, and usually they're about animals, because in the classic tradition of parables, we can relate to them somehow better when it's animals. So the one that I'm a big fan of right now is called Our Iceberg is Melting by John Cotter. Is anyone familiar with it? A bunch of penguins live on an iceberg. A couple of them are pretty sure the iceberg is melting. Turns out they're right. But a whole bunch more are in absolute denial, don't want to hear anything about it. Ring a bell? And the progress of the narrative is the progress of how change happens. So John Cotter has created a story that leads us through the change process, and it's about penguins, and it's memorable. Of course, Who Moved My Cheese is another classic example of this genre, but it's interesting to think about. It may not be something that you want to spend time crafting, but if you really want to give people an alternate vision, sometimes a parable that has nothing to do explicitly with your field can take people further than just next year, let's try this. All right, you're getting excited. You think this might be possible. So what I want to give everybody tonight is a tool for building stories. It's a versatile framework that can be used for almost any one of these 8 different types of stories that we've been talking about. It begins one day, or last Wednesday at 2 p.m., or in 1898, right? Give us a time, and give us enough of a sense of ordinary life that we care. So it was last Tuesday at 2 p.m., and everything was humming along smoothly. Suddenly, the status quo is disrupted. Now, in a lot of stories, suddenly automatically means disaster, but suddenly could be we won the lottery. Suddenly, my two-person beading business that I was operating out of my garage got a huge order from Bloomingdale's, and my partner and I were up all night stitching until our fingers bled. Luckily, the next turning point of the story. Something good happens, hopefully as a result of your ingenuity, hard work, excellent team efforts, etc. Luckily, we were able to tap into the beading passion of the East Bay and find hundreds of people who we could employ and pay well and give benefits to, and ever since then, we have had a beading emporium that serves the nation and the world. So ever since then, sometimes is immoral. Sometimes it's just the new status quo. Sometimes it's the future. And from now on, instead of ever since then, here's what we're going to do differently. It's a great way to encapsulate a lesson learned. And it's a great way to turn an anecdote about something that happened to you into something more structured that feels like a story. Because in addition to the fact that I believe we all make stories automatically, we all have a pretty strong story sense. So if I'm talking to someone or coaching them and they're developing a story, just sort of brainstorming it, if I say find an ending, they can. We know what an ending feels like. We know when the initial upset has reached a new point of resolution. We know how to cut out details and wrap things up. So story structure is something that most of us have at least something of a grasp of. And as a footnote, European story structure is often built in threes. So 3 bears, 3 wishes, 3 magic beans, etc. But if you read Native American folklore, it's often built in fours because of the 4 directions, the 4 seasons. Those are woven into the structure of the story. And for a Western reader, it can be kind of baffling because you're waiting for that arc. You're waiting for that resolution. And as one title of a collection says, Coyote was going there. The stories go along in a completely different form. But let's talk about what we know, what we're familiar with as Western story structure. So try this out. Think about a vivid experience you've had. Think about a near disaster. And see if the structure will work. Oh, and now a pictorial moment. Suddenly, luckily, a 4-leaf clover and ever since then, the double rainbow. So, you're thinking about creating your story. Your starting point has to be Why are you telling it? What's your key point? You have to have a reason for telling, and ideally you should know what it is when you start. There are some conversations where it's okay to just say, the most funny thing happened to me last week, and maybe not know what your point is. But in a business setting, no, not so good. So it could, for example, be things need to change. We need to take action. You should hire me. We should do business together. Those are all examples of a point, a reason why you might be telling a story. And then your goal is to wrap that story around your point. It could be a true tale, something that really happened. It does not have to have happened to you. It could be, I know of a thing our competitor did, and here's what the outcome was. A cautionary tale, which in a sense the Stephen Denning example I gave you earlier was a cautionary tale of the AIDS worker who wasn't accessing the World Bank's store of information. And it could be a hypothetical. It does not have to be grounded in fact to be an effective story, but you do need to introduce it as hypothetical. This could happen if we continue on this path. So going back to this idea of developing a story that conveys who you are and thinking about the craftsmanship we're talking about, if you want to make sure people remember you, lead with a story. So here's some ways that you may be able to identify some pieces of your experience that can serve you that you might not have thought about before. Start by thinking about the attributes that you want people to remember, not the things you can put on a resume, but your confidence, or your grace under pressure, or your willingness to take risks and try new things. And then try to think of some incidents that exemplify that quality. Find a partner. This is a really key part of honing your story, is find someone who's a good, trustworthy, honest listener, who you can tell the story to with one simple question, which is to ask them at the end, what did they think was your reason for telling it? Right? To entertain? Not so good. To reflect something about who you are and see if they got what you wanted them to get out of it. And then refine your story by telling it again and again. You cannot tell it in the mirror. You cannot tell it to your dog. You cannot tell it to your stuffed animal. A key piece of being a good storyteller is that it's about an emotional connection between you and your audience. So you need a live person to practice with. I will say that I use a video camera a lot as the most excruciatingly honest teacher, but telling to a camera does not teach you to reach an audience. All right, so you can practice those steps at home. Now, as you continue to craft your story and meditate upon it, see if you can find some main characters or actors. Again, if what you're trying to do is tell the story of an organization, you may need to find a person, either representative of the organization or of the people the organization helps. Individual characters are what get us listening as story listeners. Try to find some obstacles. We do not want to hear a story about how everything went perfectly. In fact, some would argue that all of Western tradition is stories about trouble. If you don't have a villain, if you don't have setbacks, if you don't have negative consequences, there's nothing at stake, and we don't care as much. So build those in. Don't hide them. Don't think, oh, I'm going to use a story to convince everybody that everything went smoothly, especially when they were there, they know. Work on creating one or two vivid images, and try to find some emotion, even if it's simply the suspense of we did not know if we were going to make it. And again, I restate, be sure that the conclusion reveals you in the light you intended. And the best way to find out is to ask. Okay, now we're going to talk about audience awareness. This is such a key part of being an effective storyteller that I would say the single most important attribute of a good storyteller is being a good listener. Now, does anyone here have a great Uncle Milty? Great Uncle Milty corners you at family gatherings and gives you long descriptions of his podiatrist's cousin's niece's toenail. and how it fell off and what color it was, right? And the whole time he's doing that, you're balancing your bagel and your orange juice and you're desperately looking for ways to escape, and he never notices. He does not see your glazed expression. He doesn't see you going, He's Great Uncle Milty. He's so wrapped up in his story, he's not connecting with you at all. And you run from him. Nobody wants to be that storyteller. So really, really tune into your audience, both before and while you're telling your story. Figure out what they love, what their passions are. Best way to do it is ask some questions or comment on your surroundings. Presumably, you can learn about people that way, why they're there. Figure out what they fear. A very powerful political storytelling technique. Tell a story about the worst possible outcomes. Figure out what they're searching for, what they're seeking. Also, try to gauge their level of expertise. This goes back to those stories that transmit knowledge. You need to tune your language so that they'll understand your story. And of course, are they interested? Right? Do you have 2 minutes to listen to a story? Okay, can we schedule a time that would be better? Because this is a really important story. I really want to share it with you. Knowing your audience's level of interest is going to be key in succeeding. I'm going to move back a little because I'm seeing people peering around me. How does that work? Good. So Uncle Milty's other problem, besides the fact that he's not paying any attention to you as an audience, is that he doesn't know the difference between important and unimportant details. And I will tell you, that is the single struggle of every storyteller. What do I put in? What do I leave out? How do I keep the spine of the tree, the trunk of the tree, growing cleanly towards its destination, but not lop off every branch, not leave it leafless, because then it's a PowerPoint again. So that's everybody's challenge, but Great Uncle Milty has never tuned in on it. He just loads on the details and goes down those side paths and takes you on a painful and excruciating journey. So know your audience and know the backbone of your story so that you can decide whether it's time for the leafy branchy version or the straight to the point version. Because every story can be this big or this big. That's what movie trailers are, right? They're the 2-minute version of the 2-hour movie. And that's why they're sometimes poisonous. They tell you the whole story. What's the point? All right, I want to talk a little bit about delivery, which could be a whole other topic. You need to tell your story. And you need to tell it enough times that you can taste the words in your mouth and that they have flowed off your lips before you're in front of your key audience. So you got to practice. And as I said, not on your dog, not on your TV. Although I will say I do rehearse sometimes on BART and people think I'm nuts. My lips are moving and so on. But that's still part of trying to get the feel of the words in my mouth. At the earliest possible point, you want to try it on a live audience. And the single biggest piece of advice I would give, going back to when I was talking to Celia before our session, is tell it like it's a juicy piece of gossip. Like it's hot news that you care a lot about. And the audience will receive that excitement and that enthusiasm, and they will get excited as well. Now, of course, you're going to work with a story partner, and you're going to ask them for feedback. And ideally, what you're going to receive is not, your lipstick was smudged. And it's not going to be, you know, the third sentence in the introduction, I think you could take out the word and. Okay, that's not helpful feedback, and you need to guide your partner in giving you more meaningful feedback. The two basic kinds of feedback that I think work best are, what did you want more of, and what did you want less of? I wanted more of you smiling and looking like you actually cared about what you were talking about. I wanted less technical detail. Those kinds of feedback are the ways that your story will improve. Don't use a script. A script will imprison you in a cage of text, and you'll be peering out between the bars at your audience, and they will see it imprinted like a barrier between you. But do use some kind of image-by-image progression through what you're planning to say. I sometimes think of it as a long boxcar train where each key point is painted on the side of that train, and it's just smoothly going past. The more imagistically you think, and by image I mean it could be a smell, it could be a sound, but it's something evocative, the more the story will come to life in your listeners' minds as well. There are people who memorize. There are people who memorize so well, it doesn't seem like they memorized. And more power to them. But I think in a business context, you're trying to do several things. You're trying to convey data and information. You're also trying to build an emotional connection with your audience, letting them see you, letting you see them and take in their responses. And I think, personally, my belief is that memorizing gets in the way. So you're going to go practice, practice, practice. You're going to look around your office. You're going to think, who do I think is a good storyteller? I wonder if they would partner with me. So that 10 minutes before my big presentation to the partners committee, I can say, hey, can I try this 2-minute talk out on you? Here's the feedback I need. What do you want more of? What do you want less of? Look for those partners. Find a business narrative coach, such as me. Find the various organizations that help with storytelling. One is that Toastmasters, one of my favorite self-help organizations, has branches dedicated specifically to storytelling. And if you've never visited a Toastmasters or found out what they're about, I really recommend it. It's just a great chance in a safe, structured environment to improve your public speaking. There's also storytelling, the folksy kind. But it's much broader than you might think. It's people sharing their experiences in a story setting. And sometimes practicing what you have to say outside a business context can help you find your natural voice and then bring it back into your corporate setting. So there's a group called storysac.org. Of course, I'm giving you the web address, storysac.org. And on their website, you will find lots of local story swaps where anybody who wants to can come and tell a story. And you can ask the audience for feedback, or you can say, don't tell me, I'm just trying it out. You can come with no idea what you're going to say. And using that famous quote, either attributed to Marilyn Monroe or T.S. Eliot, you can live by the motto, how do I know what I think till I see what I say? And I encourage you to try that sometimes when you're just beginning work on a presentation. Okay, it is 6:58. I want to close with a story. And it's a story about a rabbi who was famous far and wide for his ability to tell the perfect story for any situation. A couple would come to him almost on the verge of blows, and he would tell them a story, and they would leave with their arms around each other at peace. Business partners would come in a huge battle locked over some financial issue. He would tell them a story. Situation resolved. His apprentice said, how is this possible? Teach me. How can you have the right story for every situation? And the rabbi said, well, let me tell you a story. There was once a Russian nobleman who made up his mind that he wanted to become the finest archer in the land. And he traveled all the way to the University of Archery in Moscow. And he studied for 2 years. He perfected the art of pulling back the bowstring. His eye and his hand were steady. He shot, and after 2 years, he could hit the bullseye almost every time. His teacher said they had no more to offer. And he was on his way home, content that he had accomplished his goal, when his carriage passed through a little village, a shtetl, a group of small shacks and hovels with one bigger barn at the edge of the village. And on the side of that barn were 5 bullseyes painted on the wall with an arrow piercing the exact center. He stopped the carriage. He climbed down. He went and found the farmer whose barn it was. He said, who has done this? Who has accomplished a feat like this? I have studied for years and I can't do it. And the farmer said, well, it was Schlamazel over there, my son. And just at that moment, around the corner of the barn, comes a 7-year-old with bare, dusty feet, dragging a bow and an arrow in the dust. And the nobleman approaches him respectfully. Young man, how is it possible? I have studied for years and I can't achieve this. The boy said, well, it's pretty simple. I take the arrow, I put it in the bow, I shoot, and then I paint the target around it. And that, said the rabbi, is what I do. I collect stories, I save them, I wait for the exact moment that I can paint around the story. And so I urge you to go and fill your quiver with stories, test them, tell them, and be successful.
Thank you, Ruth. We're going to open it up for questions now. I'd like to remind our listening audience that tonight's program is Ruth Halpern, Galvanize Your Audience Through Powerful Storytelling. This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Now I'm going to open it up for questions. I'd like to ask you one question first. If someone wants to learn more about this, they can come and talk to you, and this is something, a service you offer?
Absolutely.
And you have brochures and flyers.
And I have brochures and business cards and a website and email and a handout on how to craft a story. And if you come up and talk to me, I will give you the handout. Why didn't I give it to you at first? Because you wouldn't have listened to my story.
Okay. Now, do we have any questions right now from the audience? Okay. Let me start right here.
Thank you. Ruth, thank you very much. Who's the best storyteller that you've ever heard and why? Thank you.
Ooh, what a great question. I am a huge fan of the art of storytelling outside the business context. And I recently had a chance to hear again a nationally known storyteller named Jay O'Callaghan. Jay travels the world telling stories, and some of them are based in history, and some of them are commissioned, like by the Boston Pop Symphony. And he has a very casual, humble, I would say, manner. But he has a story that he wrote called The Herring Shed. Herring are those little fish. And it's set in Canada, in Prince Edward Island. And it's a story with a song about the people who canned the herring during wartime and the effects of war on life inside this little building. And it's such a powerful mix of craftsmanship and simplicity that I urge everybody who can find it to go look. Jay O'Callaghan is his name. I would cite Gavin Newsom, and I would stand up and cheer for our great orator, Obama. I just think he's amazing. Another question.
In business, we have a lot of different personality types. We have the Myers-Briggs assessment. Is there a type of person who naturally does storytelling better than other types? For example, analysts who might be more data intensive, not as much as an extrovert, might have a harder time than, say, an extrovert in storytelling.
That's a great question. I'm not a Myers-Briggs expert, but I'm going to answer off the cuff. I think extroversion helps, but I really think it's not so much about personality as about knowing and loving the material. As in my story at the very beginning about the volunteer Celia, who was so concerned that she didn't know how to stand up and speak, but when she talked about something she cared about, she included great details. She knew automatically about how much to say. And I think consciously crafting the story is more important than the type of person you are. I've worked with storytellers whose absolutely most successful setting is one-on-one. You still need a story. You still need to create that emotional connection. I call it the back porch feeling. So when I'm speaking to a group as big as you, I'm hoping that each one of you feels like we're sitting on the back porch and we're talking about what makes a good story. And finding that voice for yourself and then bringing it into a bigger forum, I think, is one of the ways that storytellers grow.
Just to piggyback on that, I think there's. I was going to ask you if you came from a family of storytellers, minus Uncle Milty. But I think the Jews and the Irish, of which I come from a family of storytellers, and I think it happens in some ways on a cellular level, so that you are from a bardic tradition. O'Callaghan is an Irishman, and he comes from layers of people who've been storytellers. So I think no matter what you say to people, there's something, if you grew up with hearing stories, you get on a limbic level in the visual cortex how to tell a story and understand intuitively the arc of a narrative, which is a very tough thing to teach. And I think you've done an incredible job tonight.
Thank you.
Giving us sort of the boilerplate for it. So thanks.
Great. Thank you. Yes, you are correct. I come from a family of storytellers. Yes.
I'm so curious to know what you would say about using your hands and your body, because that's so obviously being modeled by you, and yet there's nothing in the presentation that addresses that.
That's a great question. I only had one slide on crafting your storytelling presentation. You'll notice I kept the mic on the stand so I could flap because I need my hands. It's too confining. A long time ago, I was a Toastmaster. And I was quite a Toastmaster. I did the competitive hierarchical thing, and I got to go to the World Conference. And I had a wonderful coach who, when I was sort of midway through this process, she said to me, "You did a great job on your speech. It was well organized. It was structured in an interesting way." But she said, "I missed you." And that was such a revelation to me. And I was lucky that that happened in my 20s because I didn't know anybody wanted me on stage. I thought I was supposed to be, you know, gone behind the mask. So when I coach people on presentation skills, I don't have a lot of guidelines about, you know, you must stand like this and you must keep your voice like this and so on. What I really try and do is help each person find their most comfortable and authentic storytelling voice. And it's different for everybody. There are, of course, distracting mannerisms, but those can be done away with a simple 5-minute video. You will see yourself going like this over and over, and you'll see that it isn't serving your message. Ideally, when you do a gesture or when you use your hands, you're in some way furthering your message. You can tell when they're just flapping in a meaningless way or when they're going in and out of pockets or whatever. And those are things that in the process of learning to control them, you can become completely tongue-tied. So polishing these storytelling skills often means just focusing on the physical at one point or just focusing on your voice at another point. And Toastmasters actually helps with that. It breaks down those tasks.
What kind of suggestions do you have for talking about things like species destruction that are kind of depressing or climate change that have just been really propagandized before you start your story?
Well, thank you for asking that. I actually think Our Iceberg is Melting is a great example of a parable, right? It's not about, oh, you people, you have your heads buried in the sand. No, it's about some penguins who have some issues. That's called externalization, and I think it's a tremendously powerful tool that storytelling puts in our hands. So telling stories either about a hypothetical community of talking penguins or focusing on one place, one setting, one person, instead of globalizing it and making it seem disastrous, to me seems like a really important tool that the movement uses and doesn't use in varying degrees.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program now where we only have time for one more question. There's a man up in front who's had his hand up for a little while. I'm going to give it to him.
Thanks for your remarks. You cautioned us away from memorization, and I fully understand that. But what do you suggest about any use of memory aids just to make sure that you don't get sort of launched and, you know, forget a turn of phrase or some really important granular piece that you really wanted to make sure was part of the presentation?
It's a great question. Kevin mentioned in the introduction, I actually do solo performance as well, and my teacher's answer to that is memorize. Get over your storytelling self. It can't all be loose. Some of it you have to memorize, and I would agree with that. That's also a place where PowerPoint can be valuable, because if you want to make sure you remember it, you probably want to make sure the audience remembers it. And instead of going for 40 slides that comprehensively summarize everything you're saying anyway, you might choose to do 5 that have those key points that you don't want to miss, and those become the 5 boxcars that take you on the journey. And memories.
All right. Well, thank you, Ruth. Ruth will be around for questions, and she has brochures. So I do want to thank our speaker, Ruth Halperin, today for her comments on Galvanize Your Audience, The Power of Storytelling. And I do want to thank our audience being here today. And with that, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 125 years of public discourse, is adjourned.